Exodus chapter 20, verse 17. It is almost identical to Deuteronomy 5:21. Exodus 20 records the Ten Commandments themselves, and Deuteronomy 5 records a discourse in which Moses recounts the Ten Commandments, adding a few phrases and explaining them a bit. Since the Deuteronomy verse is longer and provides a little more information, we will read that as our primary consideration today. And, of course, the Tenth Commandment is the command against covetousness. It is also the last of the Ten Commandments. We have been studying the Ten Commandments for about 3 months now, and it will be exciting to have studied them all the way through. Because the Tenth Commandment is short, I will read it to you from the ESV. It says this, "And you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, and you shall not desire your neighbor's house, his field, or his male servant, or his female servant, his ox or his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's." Now, my immediate first thought on the Tenth Commandment against coveting is that it is the black sheep of the commandments. It is the one that stands out as being the most different. In the first place, it is different because, as far as I can tell, it has no enforcement provisions. The law of Moses records penalties for violation of the other commandments. If a person stole something, or killed someone, or pick any of the ten, there would be some kind of penalty. However, the tenth has no penalty. This, I suppose, is because it is the most difficult, or indeed the most impossible, to prove. You can't really bring witnesses into court to testify that a person is covetous. It is a secret matter of the heart. Seeing that this matter of the heart cannot be clearly proven, it is very reasonable that there is no enforceable penalty. That is an interesting biblical precedent. It leads me to believe that crimes of thought ought never to be punished. But I suppose we'll have to keep our eyes peeled for other evidence that might confirm or negate that conjecture. Of course, the fact that this is a sin of thought is also a major distinction between the commandment and others. We have no other commandments which are thought crimes. If a person worships a false god, you can watch him engaging in worship. If a person makes an idol, you can see the idol. You can watch a person work on the Sabbath. You can watch a person commit murder. You can watch a person commit adultery. Now, coveting might have an observable effect. The thief must surely have coveted a thing before he stole it. But just as you cannot see the wind despite clearly seeing its effects, you also cannot see the coveting itself. And coveting is distinct in a third way. It is oft neglected. As a sin of thought, and an unpunishable one, I'd wager that you are significantly more likely to hear a pastor talk about the errors of some other more visible sins. I'd guess that you've heard a sermon in a brick-and-mortar church against sexual sins or murder or what have you, but you are less likely to hear about covetousness. This, of course, is interesting because the Ten Commandments tend to get such overwhelming attention in comparison to the rest of the law. I'm sure that it is much easier to skip over something that is invisible, however. I'm glad, though, that we'll be able to give covetousness its due attention today. So then, the Tenth Commandment is different from its brothers, but what does the commandment mean? Well, first off, it tells us not to covet. And what is coveting? The English word covet translates the Hebrew word chamed. This word means to desire or delight in a thing. The fruit-bearing trees of the Garden of Eden were said to be desirable in this way, and not only the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So this is not only a word which conveys a negative desirability. Sometimes desiring a thing is good. It is only bad to desire a thing under certain circumstances. So, when is it bad to desire a thing? It is bad when the thing desired is not for the person who desires it. We are, for instance, not to desire another man's wife, as both passages in Exodus and Deuteronomy tell us. And this makes sense. Desire itself is not wrong, and desiring a beautiful girl, or even an ugly girl if that's your thing, is not wrong. The desire becomes wrong when the girl is not available for you to rightly have. Your neighbor's wife is not yours, and your neighbor's wife cannot be yours rightly. She is your neighbor's. Therefore, this passage warns us that it is wrong to desire her, because she cannot be yours. And we get the idea that this desire applies to anything that belongs to your neighbor. Exodus lists your neighbor's house, his servants, whether male or female, his ox, his donkey, and indeed, anything that is his. Deuteronomy explicitly adds that your neighbor's field is also not to be coveted. That, however, is a bit of a moot point, because both passages insist that anything belonging to your neighbor should not be coveted. The things listed are simply examples. So then, the command is this: don't desire anything that is your neighbor's. It is not a command outlawing desire. It does not outlaw ambition to attain things. The law bans you from desiring that which is not and will not rightfully be yours. The New Testament sheds some light on this command. There we find the 10th commandment reiterated. Now, the Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures, and this was the translation in use at the time of Christ. The Greek word which was used to translate the Hebrew chamed is epithumeses. We find this word used in the New Testament in several contexts. Like its Hebrew counterpart, some of these uses are bad and some are good. For example, in Matthew chapter 5, verse 20, Jesus uses the verb epithumeo to describe looking with lust at another man's wife. It is a reiteration of the 10th commandment, which also explicitly says not to desire another man's wife. But we also see good kinds of desire in the New Testament. In Matthew chapter 13, for instance, Jesus says that the prophets desired to see his coming. And in Luke 22, Jesus himself desires, by this same word, to eat the Passover with his disciples. So again, we find that desire itself is not wrong, but the desire to have that which one ought not to have is wrong. Paul, in several contexts, reiterates the 10th commandment, like in Romans chapter 7, verse 7, or Romans 13, verse 9, using this same word. There, he lists the commandment as being one of the 10. He also gives us examples of inappropriate covetous behavior. In 1 Corinthians 10:6, he mentions that the Israelites who grumbled in the wilderness had coveted evil things. In Galatians 5:17, he informs us that our flesh covets things contrary to the Spirit. However, coveting is not always bad in Paul's mind either. He tells Titus that a man who covets the office of an overseer covets a good thing. So the New Testament affirms what we learned in the Old. To covet a thing is simply to desire it. A man can covet good things which are good for him to have, and that is good. Or a man can covet things which are not good for him to have, and which are not good, and that is sin. So why does coveting matter? We have already established that coveting cannot be seen or directly proved. So if it doesn't hurt anybody, why should we care about it? Well, in the first case, we should remember that the standard of morality is not, can I see a clear reason that this hurts someone? The standard of morality is whatever God imposes as a standard. In this case, God has imposed a standard that we ought not to covet what is rightly our neighbor's. We know that our first command, through which we filter all others, is that we should love God and then love our neighbor. So how does covetousness damage our relationship with God? Admittedly, much of what I say on that question is speculative. The scriptures don't have any listing of how covetousness represents a lack of love for God. However, I think I can list some ways that it does. In the first and most obvious place, unrighteous covetousness is not obedience, and a lack of obedience to God is a lack of love for God. Unrighteous covetousness also represents a lack of faith in God. We trust that God can supply our needs. To covet that which others have and which is not for us to have represents a lack of faith that God can give us enough. If we trust in God, we will have what we need when we need it. So why should we desire that which rightly belongs to others when we can have all that we need and as God wants us to have? Well, the answer is that the coveter must not trust that God will give him what he needs when he needs it, and therefore he longs for that which belongs to another. Coveting also represents a lack of thankfulness. God supplies your needs. It is good for you to be thankful for that which God has given you. However, if you are unthankful for what you have, you will always be wanting more, and this will lead you to covet. And I think we should note that covetousness, even if it is not clearly named, may have been in Jesus' mind when he delivered his Sermon on the Mount. There, he talked at length about trusting God for the things that we need, and he emphasized that we ought to pray in faith rather than worrying. Those are good actions that may help keep us from a covetous heart. So the God who made us deserves our obedience. The God who is faithful to his word deserves to be trusted. The God who gives us everything we have deserves for us to be thankful for it. A spirit of covetousness, even if only in a small way, robs God of the glory and honor which he deserves. And while coveting may not directly harm your neighbor in an overt way, coveting does represent a lack of love toward him in less obvious ways. You are commanded to love your neighbor, and to do unto him as you would have him do unto you. So is it love for your neighbor if you are more concerned with always wanting his stuff than you are with him? Would you like it if all your relationships were tainted by everyone just wanting your things? It seems to me that you should be generous with your neighbor. You should be interested in what he needs. You should be interested in giving to him, not taking from him, and particularly not taking that which doesn't belong to you and which you haven't earned. So, as far as the psychological implication goes, it seems that covetousness is selfish, and it creates an environment in which a loving relationship will not be able to flourish. However, covetousness is more damaging in that it is, in some sense, the first step toward more obvious and visible sins. If you want your neighbor's things, you are on the first step toward stealing them. Maybe you won't go all the way by actually stealing. Maybe you'll have more self-control than that. Or maybe you'll simply be unable to accomplish the task of stealing. But doesn't it seem like it would be better for your relationship to your friend if you just never thought about stealing his things at all? Wouldn't it be better if everyone in society didn't have to restrain you from stealing something? Imagine a world in which there's no need for security cameras or police or internet passwords or locking doors, because no one has a desire to take anything that isn't theirs. It seems like it would be a nice world. And indeed, if you never have the initial thought of taking something, you will never go down the path of actually taking it. A man with no coveting in him will not steal. A man with no coveting in him will not commit adultery. We might avoid the temptation to do evil altogether if we could just get our hearts in check, and the failure to do so results in many sins. I think we'll find as we continue our study in the scriptures that the heart can be more important than the hand. So I think this command is listed here and is of great importance because it is the root of a whole tree of sin. If we can dig up this root, we will destroy much bad fruit. James agrees with me on this. In James chapter 4, starting at verse 1, he wrote, "What causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? You desire and do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel." Clearly, unjust desire causes much strife and results in manifest lack of love toward one's neighbors. So we know what coveting is, and we know why it matters. But how can we guard our hearts? How do we know if we are coveting, and how much desire is too much? Well, in the first place, it is better to set our boundaries back too far than it is to set them too close. The passage says that we ought not to covet anything that is our neighbor's at all, so we would probably be best off to just guard ourselves there. If something isn't yours, if you don't have a right to it, and if there's no righteous path that you might take to obtaining it, then maybe you're best off to just not tie yourself into knots thinking about how much you'd like to have it. However, I think that coveting really becomes a spiritual problem when you begin to think about how you might do wrong to obtain the thing you want. You see your neighbor's wife, and you think about how you might seduce her. Well, that would be coveting. It would be wrong. You would be putting yourself in spiritual danger and putting your relationship to your neighbor in danger as well. In that vein, we should note that you can protect yourself against covetousness by knowing God's laws. If you understand right boundaries, and if you know the difference between right and wrong, then you can easily know whether or not it is right to do a thing, and you can know what you have a right to and what you do not have a right to. If you know what is yours, and you know what is your neighbor's, and you know what you ought not do to get your neighbor's things, then you will be on your way to pushing covetousness away from you, because you will recognize covetousness when it comes to you. So then to conclude, this is what covetousness is. It is a desire to have that which you ought not to have. It is born of a lack of trust and thankfulness to God, and when it is fully grown, it manifests itself as overt sins against one's neighbor. This is a sin of thought and of intent, not a sin of action. Therefore, to avoid this sin, we ought to be careful to guard our hearts from even the sinful thought. We ought not to even look at our neighbor's wife with desire, nor should we consider the ways that we might take advantage of him and gain his things. Maybe you haven't paid much attention to a covetous heart, but maybe you should. Covetousness may not be as obvious as many more overt sins, but it is real, and it is damaging to your relationship with your God and your neighbor. If you want to avoid covetousness, focus yourself on learning right and wrong as defined in God's laws, so that you can understand clearly what you have a right to have, and you'll understand also what you don't have a right to have. You will know the right way to get things and won't have to think about the wrong way to get them. You should also focus yourself on praying to God when you have needs and trusting Him to provide them. When He does provide them, you should be thankful for what you have. And perhaps you'll find that in doing those things, you'll have a greater relationship with God and a greater relationship with your neighbor. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.